Chapter 19. They were lying on the firm sand of the smallest of the three coves, the one they always went to when they were alone, and the girl said,
"She won't go to Switzerland."
"She shouldn't go to Madrid either. Spain is a bad place to crack up."
"I feel as though we'd been married all our lives and never had anything but problems."
She pushed his hair back from his forehead and kissed him.
"Do you want to swim now?"
"Yes. Let's dive from the high rock, the really high one."
"You do," she said. "I'll swim out and you dive over my head."
"All right, but hold still when I dive.
See how close you can come."
Looking up, she watched him poised on the high rock, arced brown against the blue sky. Then he came toward her and the water rose in a spout from a hole in the water behind her shoulder. He turned underwater and came up in front of her and shook his head. "I cut it too fine," he said. They swam out to the point and back and then wiped each other dry and dressed on the beach.
"You really liked me diving that close."
"I loved it."
He kissed her and she felt cool and fresh from the swimming, and she still tasted of the sea. Catherine came in while they were sitting at the bar. She was tired and quiet and polite. At the table, she said,
"I went to Nice and then drove the little Corniche, and I stopped up above Villefranche and watched a battle cruiser come in, and then it was late."
"You weren't very late," Marita said.
"But it was very strange," Catherine said. "All the colors were too bright. Even the grays were bright. The olive trees were glittery."
"That's the noon light," David said.
"No, I don't think so," she said. "It wasn't very nice, and it was lovely when I stopped to watch the ship. She didn't look big to have such a big name."
"Please eat some of the steak," David said. "You've eaten hardly anything."
"I'm sorry," she said. "It's good. I like tournedos."
"Would you like something instead of the meat?"
"No, I'll eat the salad. Do you think we could have a bottle of the Perrier Jouet?"
"Of course."
"It was always such a nice wine," she said. "And we were always so happy with it."
Afterward in their room, Catherine said,
"Don't worry, David, please. It's just speeded up so much lately."
"How?" he asked. He was stroking her forehead.
"I don't know. All of a sudden, I was old this morning and it wasn't even the right time of year. Then the colors started to be false. I worried and wanted to get you taken care of."
"You take wonderful care of everybody."
"I'm going to, but I was so tired and there wasn't any time, and I knew it would be so humiliating if the money ran out and you had to borrow, and I hadn't fixed up anything nor signed anything and just been sloppy the way I've been. Then I worried about your dog."
"My dog?"
"Yes, your dog in Africa in the story. I went in the room to see if you needed anything and I read the story. While you and Marita were talking in the other room, I didn't listen. You left your keys in the shorts you changed from."
"It's about half through," he told her.
"It's wonderful," she said, "but it frightens me. The elephant was so strange, and your father, too. I never liked him, but I like the dog better than anyone except you, David. And I'm so worried about him."
"He was a wonderful dog. You don't have to worry about him."
"Can I read about what happened to him today in the story?"
"Sure, if you want to. But he's at the Shamba now, and you don't need to worry about him."
"If he's all right, I won't read it until you get back to him." "Kibo. He had a lovely name."
"It's the name of a mountain. The other part is Mawensi."
"You and Kibo. I love you so much. You were so much alike."
"You're feeling better, devil."
"Probably," Catherine said. "I hope so, but it won't last. Driving this morning, I was so very happy, and then suddenly I was old. So old I didn't care anymore."
"You're not old."
"Yes, I am. I'm older than my mother's old clothes, and I won't outlive your dog, not even in a story."
Chapter 20. David had finished writing, and he was empty and hollow-feeling from having driven himself long past the point where he should have stopped. He did not think it mattered that day because it was the exhaustion part of the story, and so he had felt the tiredness as soon as they had picked up the trail again. For a long time, he had been fresher and in better shape than the two men, and impatient with their slow trailing and the regular halts his father made each hour on the hour. He could have moved ahead much faster than Juma and his father, but when he started to tire, they were the same as ever, and at noon they only took the usual 5-minute rest, and he had seen that Juma was increasing the pace a little. Perhaps he wasn't. Perhaps it had only seemed faster, but the dung was fresher now that it was not warm yet to the touch. Juma gave him the rifle to carry after they came on the last pile of dung, but after an hour he looked at him and took it back. They had been climbing steadily across a slope of the mountain, but now the trail went down and from a gap in the forest he saw the broken country ahead.
"Here's where the tough part starts, Davy," his father said.
It was then he knew that he should have been sent back to the Shamba once he had put them on the trail. Juma had known it for a long time. His father knew it now, and there was nothing to be done. It was another of his mistakes, and there was nothing to do now except gamble. David looked down at the big flattened circle of the print of the elephant foot and saw where the bracken had been pressed down and where a broken stem of a flowering weed was drying beyond the break. Juma picked it up and looked at the sun. Juma handed the broken weed to David's father, and his father rolled it in his fingers. David noticed the white flowers that were drooped and drying, but they still had not dried in the sun nor shed their petals.
"It's going to be a bitch," his father said. "Let's get going."
Late in the afternoon, they were still tracking through the broken country. He had been sleepy now for a long time, and as he watched the two men, he knew that sleepiness was his real enemy, and he followed their pace and tried to move through and out of the sleep that deadened him. The two men relieved each other, tracking on the hour, and the one who was in second place looked back at him in regular intervals to check if he was with them. When they made a dry camp at dark in the forest again, he went to sleep as soon as he sat down, and woke with Juma holding his moccasins and feeling his bare feet for blisters. His father had spread his coat over him and was sitting by him with a piece of cold cooked meat and 2 biscuits. He offered him a water bottle with cold tea.
"He'll have to feed, Davy," his father said. "Your feet are in good shape. They're as sound as Juma's. Eat this slowly and drink some tea and go to sleep again. We haven't any problem."
"I'm sorry I was so sleepy."
"You and Kibo hunted and traveled all last night. Why shouldn't you be sleepy? You can have a little more meat if you want it."
"I'm not hungry."
"Good. We're good for 3 days. We'll hit water again tomorrow. Plenty of creeks come off the mountain."
"Where's he going?"
"Juma thinks he knows."
"Isn't it bad?"
"Not too bad, Davy."
"I'm going back to sleep," David had said. "I don't need your coat."
"Juma and I are all right," his father said. "I always sleep warm, you know."
David was asleep even before his father said goodnight. Then he woke once with the moonlight on his face, and he thought of the elephant with his great ears moving as he stood in the forest. His head hung down with the weight of the tusks. David thought then in the night that the hollow way he felt as he remembered him was from waking hungry. But it was not, and he found that out in the next 3 days. In the story, he had tried to make the elephant come alive again as he and Kibo had seen him in the night when the moon had risen. "Maybe I can," David thought. "Maybe I can." But as he locked up the day's work and went out of the room and shut the door, he told himself, "No, you can't do it." The elephant was old, and if it had not been your father, it would have been someone else. There is nothing you can do except try to write it the way that it was. So you must write each day better than you possibly can, and use the sorrow that you have now to make you know how the early sorrow came. And you must always remember the things you believed, because if you know them, they will be there in the writing, and you won't betray them. The writing is the only progress you make. He went behind the bar and found the bottle of Haig and a cold half bottle of Perrier and made himself a drink, and took it out in the big kitchen to find Madame. He told her he was going into Khan and would not be back for lunch. She scolded him about drinking whiskey on an empty stomach, and he asked her what she had cold that he could put in the empty stomach with the whiskey. She brought out some cold chicken and sliced it and put it on a plate and made an endive salad, and he went into the bar and made another drink and came back to sit down at the kitchen table.
"Don't drink that now before you eat, monsieur,"
Madame said. "It's good for me," he told her. "We drank it at the mess like wine in the war."
"It's a wonder you weren't all drunkards."
"Like the French," he said, and they argued French working-class drinking habits, on which they both agreed, and she teased him that his women had left him. He said that he was tired of them both, and wasn't she ready to take their place now? "No," she said, "he would have to show more evidence he was a man before he roused a woman of the Midi." He said he was going into Cannes where he could get a proper meal and would come back like a lion and let the women of the South take care. They kissed affectionately with the kiss of the favored client and the brave femme, and then David went in to take a shower, to shave, and to change. The shower made him feel good, and he was cheered up from talking to Madame. "I wonder what she would say if she knew what it was all about," he thought. Things had changed since the war, and both Monsieur and Madame had a sense of style, and they wished to move with the change. "We three clients are all des gens très bien. So long as it pays and isn't violent, there is nothing wrong with it. The Russians are gone, the British are beginning to be poor, the Germans are ruined. And now there is this disregard of the established rules, which can very well be the salvation of the whole coast. We are pioneers in opening up the summer season, which is still regarded as madness." He looked at his face in the mirror with one side shaved. "Still," he said to himself, "you don't need to be such a pioneer as not to shave the other side." And then he noted with careful, critical distaste the almost silvery whiteness of his hair. He heard the Bugatti come up the long slope and turn onto the gravel and stop. Catherine came into the room. She had a scarf over her head and sunglasses on, and she took them off and kissed David. He held her close and said, "How are you?"
"Not so good," she said. "It was too hot."
She smiled at him and put her forehead on his shoulder.
"I'm glad I'm home."
He went out and made a Tom Collins and brought it in to Catherine, who had finished a cold shower. She took the tall, cold glass and sipped from it, and then held it against the smooth, dark skin of her belly. She touched the glass to the tips of each of her breasts so they came erect, and then took a long sip and held the cold glass against her belly again.
"This is wonderful," she said.
He kissed her, and she said,
"Oh, that's nice. I'd forgotten about that. I don't see any good reason why I should give that up, do you?"
"No."
"Well, I haven't," she said. "I'm not going to turn you over to someone else prematurely. That was a silly idea."
"Get dressed and come on out," David said.
"No, I want to have fun with you like in the old days."
"How?"
"You know, to make you happy."
"How happy?"
"This."
"Be careful," he said.
"Please." "All right, if you want. The way it was in Gros du Roi the first time it ever happened?"
"If you want."
"Thank you for giving me this time because..."
"Don't talk."
"It's just like Gros du Roi, but it's lovelier because it's in the daytime, and we love each other more because I'd gone away. Please, let's be slow and slow and slow."
"Yes, slow."
"Are you..."
"Yes."
"Are you really?"
"Yes, if you want."
"Oh, I want so much, and you are, and I have. Please be slow and let me keep it."
"You have it."
"Yes, I do. I do have it. Oh, yes, I do. I do. Please come now with me. Please, can you now?"
They lay on the sheets, and Catherine, with her brown leg over his, touching his instep lightly with her toes, rested on her elbows and lifted her mouth from his and said,
"Are you glad to have me back?"
"You," he said. "You did come back."
"You never thought I would. Yesterday it was all gone and everything was over, and now here I am. Are you happy?"
"Yes."
"Do you remember when all I wanted was to be so dark, and now I'm the darkest white girl in the world?"
"And the blondest. You're just like ivory."
"That's how I always think. You're as smooth as ivory, too." I'm so happy and I want to have fun with you the way we always had. But mine is mine. I'm not going to turn you over to her the way I was doing and keep nothing. That's over.
It's not awfully clear, David said.
But you really are fine again, aren't you?
I really am, Catherine said. I'm not gloomy or morbid or pitiful.
You're nice and lovely.
It's all wonderful and changed.
We're going to take turns, Catherine said.
You're mine today and tomorrow. And you're Marita's the next 2 days.
My God, I'm hungry.
This is the first time I've been hungry in a week.
When David and Catherine came back from swimming in the late afternoon, they drove into Cannes for the Paris papers, and then sat at the cafe and read and talked before they came home. After David had changed, he found Marita sitting at the bar reading. He recognized the book as his own, the one she had not read.
"Did you have a good swim?" she asked.
"Yes, we swam a long way out."
"Did you dive from the high rocks?"
"No."
"I'm glad of that," she said. "How is Catherine?"
"More cheerful."
"Yes. She is very intelligent."
"How are you? Are you all right?"
"Very well. I'm reading this book."
"How is it?"
"I can't tell you till day after tomorrow. I'm reading very slowly to make it last."
"What's that? The pact?"
"I suppose so. But I wouldn't worry very much about the book nor how I feel about you. It's not changed."
"All right," David said. "But I missed you very badly this morning."
"Day after tomorrow," she said. "Don't worry."
Chapter 21. The next day in the story was very bad, because long before noon he knew that it was not just the need for sleep that made the difference between a boy and men. For the first 3 hours he was fresher than they were, and he asked Juma for the .303 rifle to carry, but Juma shook his head. He did not smile, and he had always been David's best friend, and he had taught him to hunt. "He offered it to me yesterday," David thought, "and I'm in much better shape today than I was yesterday." He was, too, but by 10 o'clock he knew the day would be bad or worse than the day before. It was as silly for him to think that he could trail with his father as to think he could fight with him. He knew, too, that it was not just that they were men. They were professional hunters, and he knew now that was why Juma would not even waste a smile. They knew everything the elephant had done, pointed out the signs of it to each other without speaking, and when the tracking became difficult, his father always yielded to Juma. When they stopped to fill the water bottles at a stream, his father said, "Just last the day out, Davy." Then when they were finally past the broken country and climbing again toward the forest, the tracks of the elephant turned off to the right onto an old elephant trail. He saw his father and Juma talking, and when he got up to them, Juma was looking back over the way they had come, and then at a far distant stony island of hills in the dry country, and seemed to be taking a bearing of this against the peaks of 3 far blue hills on the horizon. "Juma knows where he's going now," his father explained. "He thought he knew before, but then he dropped down into this stuff." He looked back at the country they had come through all day. "Where he's headed now is pretty good going, but we'll have to climb." They had climbed until it was dark and then made another dry camp. David had killed 2 spur fowl with his slingshot out of a small flock that had walked across the trail just before the sunset. The birds had come into the old elephant trail to dust, walking neatly and plumply, and when the pebble broke the back of one and the bird began to jerk and toss with its wings thumping, another bird ran forward to peck at it, and David pouched another pebble and pulled it back and sent it against the ribs of the second bird. As he ran forward to put his hand on it, the other birds whirred off. Juma had looked back and smiled this time, and David picked up the 2 birds, warm and plump and smoothly feathered, and knocked their heads against the handle of his hunting knife. Now, where they were camped for the night, his father said, "I've never seen that type of Franklin quite so high. You did very well to get a double on them." Juma cooked the birds, spit it on a stick over the coals of a very small fire. His father drank a whiskey and water from the cup top of his flask as they lay and watched Juma cook. Afterward, Juma gave them each a breast with the heart in it, and ate the 2 necks and backs and legs himself. "It makes a great difference, Davy," his father said.
We're very well off on rations now.
How far are we behind him? David asked.
We're quite close, actually, his father said. It all depends on whether he travels when the moon comes up. It's an hour later tonight and 2 hours later than when you found him.
Why does Juma think he knows where he's going?
He wounded him and killed his Askari not too far from here.
When?
5 years ago, he says. That may mean any time. When you were still a Toto, he says.
Has he been alone since then?
He says so. He hasn't seen him, only heard of him.
How big does he say he is?
Close to 200. Bigger than anything I've ever seen. He says there's only been one greater elephant, and he came from near here, too.
I'd better get to sleep, David said. I hope I'll be better tomorrow.
You were splendid today, his father said. I was very proud of you. So was Juma.
In the night when he woke after the moon was up, he was sure they were not proud of him, except perhaps for his dexterity in killing the two birds. He had found the elephant at night and followed him to see that he had both of his tusks, and then returned to find the two men and put them on the trail.
David knew they were proud of that. But once the deadly following started, he was useless to them, and a danger to their success, just as Kibo had been to him when he had gone up close to the elephant in the night. And he knew they must each have hated themselves for not having sent him back when there was time. The tusks of the elephant weighed 200 pounds apiece. Ever since these tusks had grown beyond their normal size, the elephant had been hunted for them, and now the three of them would kill him. David was sure that they would kill him now because he, David, had lasted through the day and kept up after the pace had destroyed him by noon. So they probably were proud of him doing that. But he had brought nothing useful to the hunt, and they would have been far better off without him. Many times during the day he had wished that he had never betrayed the elephant, and in the afternoon he remembered wishing that he had never seen him. Awake in the moonlight, he knew that was not true. All morning writing, he had been trying to remember truly how he felt and what had happened on that day. The hardest to make truly was how he had felt and keep it untinctured by how he had felt later. The details of the country were sharp and clear as the morning, until the foreshortening and prolongation of exhaustion, and he had written that well, but his feeling about the elephant had been the hardest part, and he knew he would have to get away from it, and then come back to it to be certain it was as it had been, not later but on that day. He knew the feeling had begun to form, but he had been too exhausted to remember it exactly. Still involved in this problem and living in the story, he locked up his suitcase and came out of the room onto the flagstones that led down to the terrace, where Marito was sitting in a chair under one of the pines facing out toward the sea. She was reading, and as he was walking barefooted, she did not hear him. David looked at her and was pleased to see her. Then he remembered the preposterous situation and turned into the hotel and walked to his and Catherine's own room. She wasn't in the room, and still feeling Africa to be completely real and all of this where he was to be unreal and false, he went out on the terrace to speak to Marita. "Good morning," he said. "Have you seen Catherine?"
"She went off somewhere," the girl said. "She said to tell you she'd be back."
Suddenly it was not unreal at all.
"You don't know where she went?"
"No,"
the girl said.
"She went off on her bike."
"My God," David said, "she hasn't ridden a bike since we bought the bug."
"That's what she said. She's taking it up again. Did you have a good morning?"
"I don't know. I'll know tomorrow."
"Are you eating breakfast?"
"I don't know. It's late."
"I wish you would."
"I'll go in and get cleaned up," he told her. He had taken a shower and was shaving when Catherine came in. She was wearing an old Gros de Roi shirt and short linen slacks chopped off below the knees, and she was hot and her shirt was wet through.
"It's wonderful," she said, "but I'd forgotten what it does to your upper thighs when you climb."
"Did you ride very far, devil?"
6 kilometers, she said. "It was nothing, but I'd forgotten about the coat."
"It's awfully hot to ride now unless you go in the very early mornings," David said. "I'm glad you started again, though." She was under the shower now, and when she came out, she said,
"Now see how dark we are together? We're just the way we planned."
"You're darker."
"Not much. You're terribly dark, too. Look at us together."
They looked at each other, standing, touching in the long mirror on the door.
Oh, you like us, she said. That's nice. So do I. Touch here and see.
She stood very straight and he put his hand on her breasts.
I'll put on one of my tight shirts so you can tell what I think about things, she said.
Isn't it funny our hair hasn't any color at all when it's wet? It's pale as seaweed.
She took a comb and combed her hair straight back so it looked as though she had just come out of the sea.
I'm going to wear mine this way now again, she said. Like Rodois and here in the spring.
I like it across your forehead.
I'm tired of that, but I can do it if you like. Do you think we could go into town and have breakfast at the cafe?
Haven't you had breakfast?
I wanted to wait for you.
All right, he said. Let's go in and get breakfast. I'm hungry too. They had a very good breakfast of café au lait, brioche, and strawberry jam and œufs au plat avec jambon. And when they were finished, Catherine asked,
Would you come over with me to Jean's? It's the day I go to get my hair washed and I'm going to have it cut.
I'll wait here for you.
Wouldn't you please come? You did it before and it wasn't bad for anybody.
No, devil, I did once, but that was just once. Like getting tattooed or something. Don't ask me to.
It doesn't mean anything except to me. I want us to be just the same.
We can't be the same.
Yes, we could if you'd let us.
I really don't want to do it.
Not if I say it's all I want?
Why can't you want something that makes sense?
I do. But I want us to be the same, and you almost are, and it wouldn't be any trouble to do. The sea's done all the work.
Then let the sea do it.
I want it for today.
Then you'll be happy, I suppose.
I'm happy now because you're going to do it, and I'll stay happy.
You love how I look, you know you do.
Think of it that way.
It's silly.
No, it isn't. Not when it's you, and you do it to please me.
How badly will you feel if I don't?
I don't know, but very.
All right, he said. It really means all that to you.
Yes, she said. Oh, thank you. It won't take very long this time. I told Jean we'd be there, and he's staying open for us.
Are you always that confident I'll do things?
I knew you would if you knew how much I wanted it.
I wanted very much not to. You shouldn't ask it.
You won't care. It's nothing, and afterwards it will be fun. Don't worry about Marita.
What about her?
She said that if you wouldn't do it for me, to ask you if you'd do it for her.
Don't make things up.
No. She said it this morning.
I wish you could see yourself, Catherine said. I'm glad I can't.
I wish you'd looked in the glass.
I couldn't.
Just look at me. That's how you are, and I did it, and there's nothing you can do now. That's how you look.
We couldn't really have done that, David said.
I couldn't look the way you do. Well, we did, Catherine said, and you do. So you better start to like it.
We can't have done that, devil.
Yes, we did. You knew it, too. You just wouldn't look. And we're damned now. I was, and now you are. Look at me, and see how much you like it.
David looked at her eyes that he loved, and at her dark face, and the incredibly flat ivory color of her hair, and at how happy she looked. And he began to realize what a completely stupid thing he had permitted. Chapter 22. He did not think that he could go on with the story that morning, and for a long time he could not. But he knew that he must, and finally he had started, and they were following the spoor of the elephant on an old elephant trail that was a hard, packed, worn road through the forest. It looked as though elephants had traveled it ever since the lava had cooled from the mountain, and the trees had first grown tall and close. Juma was very confident, and they moved fast. Both his father and Juma seemed very sure of themselves, and the going on the elephant road was so easy that Juma gave him the 303 to carry, as they went on through the broken light of the forest. Then they lost the trail in smoking piles of fresh dung and the flat round prints of elephant herds that had come onto the elephant road from a heavy forest on the left of the trail. Juma had taken the 303 from David angrily. It was afternoon before they had worked up to the herd and around it, seeing the gray bulks through the trees, and the movement of the big ears and the searching trunks coiling and uncoiling, the crash of branches broken,
the crash of trees pushed over and the rumbling in the bellies of the elephants, and the slap and thud of the dung falling. They had found the trail of the old bull, finally, and when it turned off onto a smaller elephant road, Juma had looked at David's father and grinned, showing his filed teeth, and his father had nodded his head. They looked as though they had a dirty secret, just as they had looked when he had found them that night at the Shamba. It was not very long before they came on the secret. It was off to the right in the forest, and the tracks of the old bull led to it. It was a skull as high as David's chest, and white from the sun and the rains. There was a deep depression in the forehead, and ridges ran from between the bare white eye sockets and flared out in empty broken holes where the tusks had been chopped away. Juma pointed out where the great elephant they were trailing had stood, while he looked down at the skull, and where his trunk had moved it a little way from the place it had rested on the ground, and where the points of his tusks had touched the ground beside it. He showed David the single hole in the big depression in the white bone of forehead, and then the four holes close together in the bone around the ear hole. He grinned at David and at his father, and took a 303 solid from his pocket and fitted the nose into the hole in the bone of the forehead. "Here is where Juma wounded the big bull," his father said. "This was his askari, his friend, really, because he was a big bull, too. He charged, and Juma knocked him down and finished him in the ear." Juma was pointing out the scattered bones and how the big bull had walked around among them. Juma and David's father were both very pleased with what they had found.
"How long do you suppose he and his friend had been together?" David asked his father.
"I haven't the faintest idea," his father said. "Ask Juma."
"You ask him, please."
His father and Juma spoke together, and Juma had looked at David and laughed. "Probably 4 or 5 times your life," he says, David's father told him. "He doesn't know or care, really."
"I care," David thought. "I saw him in the moonlight, and he was alone, but I had Kibo. Kibo has me, too. The bull wasn't doing anyone any harm, and now we've tracked him to where he came to see his dead friend, and now we're going to kill him. It's my fault. I betrayed him."
Now Juma had worked out the trail and motioned to his father, and they started on.
"My father doesn't need to kill elephants to live," David thought.
"Juma would not have found him if I had not seen him. He had his chance at him, and all he did was wound him and kill his friend. Kibo and I found him, and I should never have told them, and I should have kept him secret and had him always and let them stay drunk with their bibis and the beer shamba. Juma was so drunk we could not wake him. I'm going to keep everything a secret always. I'll never tell them anything again. If they kill him, Juma will drink his share of the ivory, or just buy himself another goddamn wife. Why didn't you help the elephant when you could? All you had to do was not go on the second day."
"No, that wouldn't have stopped them. Juma would have gone on. You never should have told them. Never, never tell them. Try and remember that. Never tell anyone anything, ever. Never tell anyone anything again."
His father waited for him to come up and said very gently, "He rested here. He's not traveling as he was. We'll be up on him any time now."
"Fuck elephant hunting," David had said very quietly.
"What's that?" his father asked.
"Fuck elephant hunting," David said softly.
"Be careful you don't fuck it up," his father had said to him, and looked at him flatly.
That's one thing, David had thought. He's not stupid. He knows all about it now, and he will never trust me again. That's good. I don't want him to, because I'll never tell him or anybody anything again. Never anything again. Never, ever, never.
That was where he stopped in the hunt that morning. He knew he did not have it right yet. He had not gotten to the enormity of the skull as they had come on to it in the forest, nor the tunnels underneath it in the earth that the beetles had made and that had been revealed like deserted galleries or catacombs when the elephant had moved the skull. He had not made the great length of the whitened bones, nor how the elephant's tracks had moved around the scene of the killing, and how following them he had been able to see the elephant as he had moved, and then had been able to see what the elephant had seen. He had not gotten the great width of the one elephant trail that was a perfect road through the forest, nor the worn, smooth, rubbing trees, nor the way other trails intersected, so that they were like a map of the metro in Paris. He had not made the light in the forest where the trees came together at their tops, and he had not clarified certain things that he must make as they were then, not as he recalled them now. The distances did not matter, since all distances changed, and how you remembered them was how they were. But his change of feeling toward Juma, and toward his father, and toward the elephant was complicated by the exhaustion that had bred it. Tiredness brought the beginning of understanding. The understanding was beginning, and he was realizing it as he wrote. But the dreadful true understanding was all to come, and he must not show it by arbitrary statements of rhetoric, but by remembering the actual things that had brought it. Tomorrow he would get the things right, and then go on. He put the cahiers of manuscript away in the suitcase and locked it, and came out the door of his room and walked along the front of the hotel to where Marita was reading.
"Do you want breakfast?" she asked.
"I think I'd like a drink."
"Let's have it at the bar," she said. "It's cooler."
They went in and sat down on stools, and David poured from the Haig pinch bottle into a glass and filled it up with cold Perrier.
"What became of Catherine?" "She left very happy and gay."
"And how are you?"
"Happy and shy and rather quiet."
"Too shy for me to kiss you?" They held each other, and he could feel himself start to be whole again. He had not known just how greatly he had been divided and separated, because once he started to work, he wrote from an inner core which could not be split, nor even marked, nor scratched. He knew about this, and it was his strength, since all the rest of him could be riven. They sat at the bar while the boy laid the table, and the first coolness of fall was in the breeze from the sea, and then sitting at the table under the pines, they felt it again as they ate and drank. "This cool breeze comes all the way from Kurdistan," David said. "The equinoctial storms will be coming soon."
"They won't come today," the girl said. "We don't have to worry about them today."
"There hasn't been a blow of any kind since when we met in Cannes at the cafe."
"Can you still remember things that long ago?"
"It seems further away than the war."
"I had the war the last 3 days," the girl said. "I just left it this morning."
"I never think about it," David said.
"Now I've read it,"
Marita told him.
"But I don't understand about you. You never made clear what you believed."
He filled her glass and then refilled his own. "I didn't know until afterwards," he said. "So I didn't try to act as though I did. I suspended thinking about it while it was happening. I only felt and saw and acted and thought tactically. That's why it's not a better book. Because I wasn't more intelligent."
"It's a very good book. The flying parts are wonderful, and the feeling for the other people and for the planes themselves."
"I'm good on other people and on technical and tactical things," David said. "I don't mean to talk wet or to brag, but Marita, nobody knows about himself when he is really involved. Yourself isn't worth considering. It would be shameful at the time."
"But afterwards, you know."
"Sure, sometimes."
"Can I read the narrative?"
David poured the wine in the glasses again. "How much did she tell you?"
"She said she told me everything. She tells things very well, you know."
"I'd rather you didn't read it," David said. "All it would do is make trouble. I didn't know there would be you when I wrote it. And I can't help her telling you things, but I don't have to have you read about them, too."
"Then I mustn't read it?"
"I wish you wouldn't. I don't want to give you orders."
"Then I have to tell you,"
the girl said. "She let you read it?"
"Yes. She said I should."
"God damn her."
"She didn't do it to do wrong. It was when she was so worried."
"So you read it all?"
"Yes, it's wonderful. It's so much better than the last book, and now the stories are so much better than it or than anything."
"What about the Madrid part?" He looked at her, and she looked up at him, and then moistened her lips, and did not look away, and she said very carefully,
"I knew all about that because I'm just the way you are."
When they were lying together, Marita said,
"You don't think about her when you make love to me?"
"No, stupid."
You don't want me to do her things? Because I know them all and I can do them.
Stop talking and just feel.
I can do them better than she can.
Stop talking. Don't think you have to. Don't talk.
But you don't have to.
No one has to, but we are. They lay holding each other close and hard, and then gently finally, and Marita said,
I have to go away, but I'll be back. Please sleep for me.
She kissed him, and when she came back, he was asleep. He had meant to wait for her, but he had fallen asleep while he waited. She lay down by him and kissed him, and when he did not wake, she lay by him very quietly and tried to sleep too. But she was not sleepy, and she kissed him very softly again, and then commenced to play with him very gently while she pushed her breasts against him. He stirred in his sleep, and she lay now with her head down below his chest, and played softly and searchingly, making small intimacies and discoveries. It was a long, cool afternoon, and David slept, and when he woke, Marita was gone, and he heard the two girls' voices on the terrace. He dressed and unbolted the door to his working room, and then came out from the door of that room onto the flagstones. There was no one on the terrace except the waiter who was taking in the tea things, and he found the girls in the bar. Chapter 23. The two girls were both sitting at the bar with a bottle of Perrier Jouet in a bucket with ice, and they both looked fresh and lovely.
It's just like meeting an ex-husband, Catherine said. It makes me feel very sophisticated.
She had never looked gayer or more lovely.
I must say it agrees with you.
She looked at David in mock appraisal.
Do you think he's all right?
Marita said. She looked at David and blushed.
And well, you might blush, Catherine said. Look at her, David.
She looks very well, David said.
So do you.
She looks about 16, Catherine said.
She said she told you about reading the narrative.
I think you should have asked me, David said.
I know I should, Catherine said. But I started to read it for myself, and then it was so interesting, I thought Eris ought to read it too.
I'd have said no.
But the point is, Catherine said, if he ever says no about anything, Marita, just keep right on. It doesn't mean a thing.
I don't believe it, Marita said.
She smiled at David.
That's because he hasn't written the narrative up to date. When he does, you'll find out.
I'm through with the narrative, David said.
That's dirty, Catherine said. That was my present and our project.
He must write it, David, the girl said. You will, won't you?
She wants to be in it, David, Catherine said. And it will be so much better when you have a dark girl, too.
David poured himself a glass of the champagne. He saw Marita look at him, a warning, and he said to Catherine, I'll go on with it when I finish the stories. What did you do with your day?
I had a fine day. I made decisions and planned things.
Oh, God, David said.
They're all straightforward plans, Catherine said. You don't have to groan about them. You've been doing just whatever you wanted to do all day, and I was pleased. But I have a right to make a few plans.
What sort of plans? David asked. His voice sounded very flat.
First, we have to start seeing about getting the book out. I'm going to have the manuscript typed up to where it is now and see about getting illustrations. I have to see the artists and make the arrangements.
You've had a very busy day, David said. You know, don't you, that you don't get manuscripts typed until whoever writes them has gone over them and has them ready for typing.
That isn't necessary because I only need a rough draft to show the artists.
I see. And if I don't want it copied yet?
Don't you want it brought out? I do.
And someone has to get started on something practical. Who are the artists you thought up today?
Different ones for different parts. Marie Laurencin, Pasquin, Derain, Dufy, and Picasso.
For Christ's sake, Derain?
Can't you see a nice Laurencin of Marita and me in the car when we stopped the first time by the Louvre on the way to Nice?
Nobody's written that.
Well, write it then.
It's certainly much more interesting and instructive than a lot of natives in a crawl, or whatever you call it, covered with flies and scabs in Central Africa, with your drunken father staggering around smelling of sour beer and not knowing which ones of the little horrors he had fathered.
There goes the ball game, David said.
What did you say, David?
Marita said.
I said thank you very much for having lunch with me, David told her. Why don't you thank her for the rest of it, Catherine said.
She really must have done something impressive to make you sleep as though you were dead until the absolute end of the afternoon. Thank her for that, at least.
Thank you for going swimming, David said to the girl.
Oh, did you swim? Catherine said. I'm glad you swam.
We swam quite far, Marita said.
And we had a very good lunch. Did you have a good lunch, Catherine?
I think so, Catherine said. I don't remember.
Where were you?
Marita asked gently.
San Rafael, Catherine said. I remember stopping there, but I can't remember about lunch. I never notice when I eat by myself. But I'm quite sure I did have lunch there. I know I intended to.
Was it nice driving back? Marita asked. It was such a cool, lovely afternoon.
I don't know, Catherine said. I didn't notice. I was thinking about making the book and getting it started. We have to get it started. I don't know why David started to be difficult the moment I commenced to put a little order into it. The whole thing has dragged along in such a haphazard way that I was suddenly ashamed of all of us.
Poor Catherine, Marita said. But now that you have it all planned, you must feel better.
I do, Catherine said. I felt so happy when I came in. I knew I'd made you happy and I'd accomplished something practical, too. And then David made me feel like an idiot or a leper. I can't help it if I'm practical and sensible.
I know, devil, David said. I just didn't want to get the work mixed up.
But it's you who mixed it up, Catherine said. Can't you see? Jumping back and forth trying to write stories when all you had to do was keep on with the narrative that meant so much to all of us. It was going so well, too, and we were just coming to the most exciting parts. Someone has to show you that the stories are just your way of escaping your duty.
Marita looked at him again, and he knew what she was trying to tell him, and he said, I have to go get cleaned up. You tell Marita about it, and I'll be back.
We have other things to talk about, Catherine said. I'm sorry I was rude about you and Marita. I couldn't be happier about you, really.
David took everything that had been said in with him to the bathroom where he had a shower and changed into a newly washed fisherman sweater and slacks. It was quite cool now in the evening, and Marita was sitting at the bar looking at Vogue.
She's gone down to see about your room, Marita said.
How is she?
How should I know, David? She's a very great publisher now. She's given up sex. It doesn't interest her anymore. It's childish, really, she says. She doesn't know how it could ever have meant anything to her, but she may decide to have an affair with another woman if she ever takes it up again. There's quite a bit about another woman.
Christ, I never thought it would go this way.
Don't, Marita said. No matter what or how it is, I love you and you are going to write tomorrow.
Catherine came in and said, You look wonderful together and I'm so proud. I feel as though I'd invented you.
Was he good today, Marita?
We had a nice lunch, Marita said.
Please be fair, Catherine.
Oh, I know he's a satisfactory lover, Catherine said. He's always that. That's just like his martinis, or how he swims, or skis, or flew, probably. I never saw him with a plane. Everyone says he was marvelous. It's like acrobats, really, I suppose, and just as dull. I wasn't asking about that.
You were very good to let us spend a day together, Catherine, Marita said.
You can spend the rest of your lives together, Catherine said, if you don't bore each other.
I have no further need of either of you.
David was watching her in the mirror, and she looked calm, handsome, and normal. He could see Marita looking at her very sadly.
I do like to look at you, though, and I'd like to hear you talk if you'd ever open your mouths.
How do you do? Said David.
That was quite a good effort, Catherine said. I'm very well.
Have any new plans? David asked. He felt as though he were hailing a ship.
Only what I've told you, Catherine went on. They'll probably keep me quite busy.
What was all the guff about another woman? He felt Marita kick him and put his foot on hers to acknowledge.
That's not guff, Catherine said.
I want to have one more try to see if I've missed anything. I might have.
All of us are fallible, David said, and Marita kicked him again.
I want to see, Catherine said. I know enough about that now, so I should be able to tell. Don't worry about your dark girl. She's not my type at all. She's yours. She's what you like and very nice, but it's not for me. I'm not attracted to the gammon type.
Perhaps I am a gammon, Marita said. That's a very polite word for that part.
But I'm also more of a woman than you are, Catherine.
Go ahead and show David what sort of a gammon you are. He'd like it.
He knows what sort of a woman I am.
That's splendid, Catherine said.
I'm glad you both found your tongues finally. I do prefer conversation.
You aren't really a woman at all, Marita said.
I know it, Catherine said. I've tried to explain it to David often enough. Isn't that true, David?
David looked at her and said nothing.
Didn't I?
Yes, he said.
I did try, and I broke myself in pieces in Madrid to be a girl, and all it did was break me in pieces, Catherine said. Now all I am is through. You're a girl and a boy both, and you really are. You don't have to change, and it doesn't kill you, and I'm not. And now I'm nothing. All I wanted was for David and you to be happy. Everything else I invent.
Marita said,
I know it, and I tried to tell David.
I know you do, but you don't have to be loyal to me or to anything. Don't do it. Nobody would anyway, and you probably aren't really. But I tell you not to be. I want you to be happy and make him happy. You can too, and I can't, and I know it.
You're the finest girl there is, Marita said.
I'm not. I'm finished before I ever started.
No, I'm the one, Marita said. I was stupid and awful.
You weren't stupid. Everything you said was true. Let's stop talking and be friends, can we?
Can we please? Marita asked her.
I want to, Catherine said, and not be such a tragic bully. Please take your time about the book, David. You know all I want for you is to write the best you can. That's what we started with. I'm over it now, whatever this one was.
You were just tired, David said.
I don't think you ate any lunch either.
Probably not, Catherine said, but I may have.
Can we forget it all now, though, and just be friends?
So they were friends. Whatever friends are, David thought. And tried not to think, but talked and listened in the unreality that reality had become. He had heard each one speak about the other, and he knew each must know what the other thought, and probably what they each had told him. In that way, they really were friends, understanding in their basic disagreement, trusting in their complete distrust, and enjoying one another's company. He enjoyed their company too, but tonight he'd had enough of it. Tomorrow he must go back into his own country, the one that Catherine was jealous of and that Marita loved and respected. He had been happy in the country of the story, and knew that it was too good to last. And now he was back from what he cared about into the overpopulated vacancy of madness that had taken now the new turn of exaggerated practicality. He was tired of it, and he was tired of Marita's collaborating with her enemy. Catherine was not his enemy except as she was himself in the unfinding, unrealizable quest that is love, and so was her own enemy. She needs an enemy so badly always that she has to keep one near. And she's the nearest and easiest to attack, knowing the weaknesses and strengths and all the faults of our defenses. She turns my flank so skillfully, then finds it is her own. And the last fighting is always in a swirl, and the dust that rises is our own dust. Catherine wanted to play backgammon with Marita after dinner. They always played it seriously and for money, and when Catherine went to get the board, Marita said to David,
Please don't come to my room tonight after all.
Good.
Do you understand?
Let's skip that word, David said. His coldness had come back as the time for working moved closer.
Are you angry?
Yes, David said.
At me?
No.
You can't be angry with someone who's ill.
You haven't lived very long, David said. That's exactly who everyone is always angry with. Get ill sometime yourself and see.
I wish you wouldn't be angry.
I wish I'd never seen any of you.
Please don't, David.
You know it isn't true. I'm only getting ready to work. He went into their bedroom and put on the reading light on his side of the bed and made himself comfortable and read one of the W.H. Hudson books. It was Nature in Dawnland, and he had taken it to read because it had the most unpromising title. He knew enough to know a time was coming when he'd need all the books, and he was saving the best ones. But once past the title of this one, nothing in it bored him. He was happy to read, and he was back out of his life and with Hudson and his brother, riding their horses into the tumbled whiteness of breast-high thistledown in the moonlight.
And gradually, the click of dice and the low sound of the girls' voices became real again, too. So that when, after a time, he went out to make himself a whiskey and Perrier to take back to his reading, they seemed, when he saw them playing, to be actual human beings doing something normal, and not figures in some unbelievable play he had been brought unwillingly to attend. He went back to the room and read, and drank his whiskey and Perrier very slowly. And he had undressed and turned the light off and was almost asleep when he heard Catherine come into the bedroom. It seemed to him that she was gone a long time in the bathroom before he felt her come to bed, and he lay still and breathed steadily and hoped he might really go to sleep.
"Are you awake, David?" she asked.
"I think so."
"Don't wake up," she said. "Thank you for sleeping here."
"I usually do."
"You don't have to."
"Yes, I do."
"I'm glad you did. Good night."
"Good night."
"Would you kiss me good night?"
"Sure," he said. He kissed her, and it was Catherine as she had been before when she had seemed to come back to him for a while.
"I'm sorry I was such a failure again."
"Let's not talk about things."
"Do you hate me?"
"No."
"Can we start again the way I'd planned things?"
"I don't think so."
"Then why did you come in here?"
"This is where I belong."
"No other reason?"
"I thought you might be lonely."
"I was."
"Everybody's lonely," David said.
"It's terrible to be in bed together and be lonely."
"There isn't any solution," David said. "All your plans and schemes are worthless."
"I didn't give it a chance."
"It was all crazy anyway. I'm sick of crazy things. You're not the only one who gets broken up."
"I know, but can't we try it again just once more and I really be good? I can. I nearly was."
"I'm sick of it all, devil. Sick all the way through me."
"Wouldn't you try it just once more for her and for me both?"
"It doesn't work and I'm sick of it."
"She said you had a fine day and that you were really cheerful and not depressed. Won't you try it once more for both of us? I want it so much."
"You want everything so much, and when you get it, it's over, and you don't give a damn."
"I was just overconfident this time, and then I get insufferable. Please, can we try it again?"
"Let's go to sleep, devil, and not talk about it."
"Kiss me again, please," Catherine said. "I'll go to sleep because I know you'll do it."
"You always do everything I want, because you really want to do it too." "You only want things for you, devil."
"That's not true, David." "Anyway, I am you and her. That's what I did it for. I'm everybody."
"You know about that, don't you?" "Go to sleep, devil."
"I will. But would you please kiss me again first so that we won't be lonely?"
Chapter 24. In the morning, he was on the far slope of the mountain again. The elephant was no longer traveling as he had been out, but was moving aimlessly now, feeding occasionally, and David had known they were getting close to him. He tried to remember how he had felt. He had no love for the elephant yet. He must remember that. He had only a sorrow that had come from his own tiredness, that had brought an understanding of age. Though being too young, he had learned how it must be to be too old. He was lonesome for Kibo, and thinking of Juma killing the elephant's friend had turned him against Juma and made the elephant his brother. He knew then how much it meant to him to have seen the elephant in the moonlight and for him to have followed him with Kibo and come close to him in the clearing so that he had seen both of the great tusks. But he did not know that nothing would ever be as good as that again. Now he knew they would kill the elephant, and there was nothing he could do about it. He had betrayed the elephant when he had gone back to tell them at the Shamba. "They would kill me, and they would kill Kibo, too, if we had ivory," he had thought, and known it was untrue. "Probably the elephant is going to find where he was born now, and they'll kill him there. That's all they'll need to make it perfect. They like to have killed him where they killed his friend. That would be a big joke. That would have pleased them, the goddamn friend killers." They had moved to the edge of thick cover now, and the elephant was close ahead. David could smell him, and they could all hear him pulling down branches and the snapping that they made. His father put his hand on David's shoulder to move him back and have him wait outside, and then he took a big pinch of ashes from the pouch in his pocket and tossed it in the air. The ash barely slanted toward them as it fell, and his father nodded at Juma and bent down to follow him into the thick cover. David watched their backs and their asses go in and out of sight. He could not hear them move. David had stood still and listened to the elephant feeding. He could smell him as strongly as he had the night in the moonlight, when he had worked up close to him and had seen his wonderful tusks. Then as he stood there it was silent, and he could not smell the elephant. Then there had been a high squealing and smashing and a shot by the 303, then the heavy rocking double report of his father's 450. Then the smashing and crashing had gone on, going steadily away. And he had gone into the heavy growth and found Juma standing, shaken and bleeding from his forehead all down over his face, and his father white and angry. He went for Juma and knocked him over, his father had said. Juma hit him in the head.
Where did you hit him?
Where I fucking well could, his father had said. Get on the fucking blood spore. There was plenty of blood. One stream as high as David's head that had squirted bright on trunks and leaves and vines, and another much lower that was dark and foul with stomach content. Lung and gut shot, his father said. We'll find him down or anchored, I hope the hell, he added. They found him anchored, in such suffering and despair that he could no longer move. He had crashed through the heavy cover where he had been feeding and crossed a path of open forest, and David and his father had run along the heavy, splashed blood trail. Then the elephant had gone on into thick forest, and David had seen him ahead, standing gray and huge against the trunk of a tree. David could only see his stern, and then his father moved ahead of him and he followed, and they came alongside the elephant as though he was a ship, and David saw the blood coming from his flanks and running down his sides, and then his father raised his rifle and fired, and the elephant turned his head, with the great tusks moving heavy and slow, and looked at them. And when his father fired the second barrel, the elephant seemed to sway like a felled tree and came smashing down toward them. But he was not dead. He had been anchored, and now he was down with his shoulder broken. He did not move, but his eye was alive and looked at David. He had very long eyelashes, and his eye was the most alive thing David had ever seen. Shoot him in the ear hole with the 303, his father said. Go on.
You shoot him, David had said.
Juma had come up limping and bloody, the skin of his forehead hanging down over his left eye, the bone of his nose showing and one ear torn, and had taken the rifle from David without speaking, and pushed the muzzle almost into the ear hole and fired twice, jerking the bolt and driving it forward angrily. The eye of the elephant had opened wide on the first shot, and then started to glaze, and blood came out of the ear and ran in two bright streams down the wrinkled gray hide. It was a different colored blood, and David had thought I must remember that, and he had, but it had never been of any use to him. Now all the dignity and majesty and all the beauty was gone from the elephant, and he was a huge wrinkled pile. Well, we got him, Davy, thanks to you, his father had said. Now we'd better get a fire going so I can put Juma back together again. Come here, you bloody Humpty Dumpty. Those tusks will keep. Juma had come to him grinning, bringing the tail of the elephant that had no hairs on it at all. They had made a dirty joke, and then his father had begun to speak rapidly in Swahili. How far to water? How far will you have to go to get people to get those tusks out of here? How are you, you worthless old pig fucker? What have you broken? Then, with the answers known, his father had said, You and I will go back to get the packs where we dropped them when we went in after him. Juma can get wood and have the fire ready. The medical kit is in my pack. We have to get the packs before it's dark. He won't infect. It's not like claw wounds. Let's go. His father had known how he felt about the elephant, and that night, and in the next few days, he had tried, if not to convert him, to bring him back to the boy he had been before he had come to the knowledge that he hated elephant hunting. David had put no statement of his father's intention, which had never been stated, in the story, but had only used the happenings, the disgusts, the events and feelings of the butchering, and the work of chopping out the tusks, and of the rough surgery on Juma disguised by mockery and raillery to keep the pain in contempt and reduce its stature since there were no drugs. The added responsibility David was given, and the trust that was offered him and not accepted, he had put in the story without pointing their significance. He had tried to make the elephant alive beneath the tree, anchored in his final anguish, and drowning in the blood that had flowed so many times before, but always staunched, and was now rising in him so he could not breathe. The great heart pumping it to drown him as he watched the man who came to finish him. David had been so proud the elephant had scented Juma and charged him instantly. He would have killed Juma if his father had not fired into him so that he had thrown Juma into the trees with his trunk and charged on with the death in him, feeling it as only another wound until the blood welled up and he could not breathe against it. That evening, as David had sat by the fire, he had looked at Juma with his stitched-up face and his broken ribs that he tried to breathe without, and wondered if the elephant had recognized him when he had tried to kill him. He hoped he had. The elephant was his hero now, as his father had been for a long time, and he had thought, I did not believe he could do it when he was so old and tired. He would have killed Juma too. But he didn't look at me as though he wanted to kill me. He only looked sad, the same way I felt. He visited his old friend on the day he died. It was a very young boy's story, he knew, when he had finished it. He read it over and saw the gaps he must fill in to make it so that whoever read it would feel it was truly happening as it was read, and he marked the gaps in the margin. He remembered how the elephant lost all dignity as soon as his eye had ceased to be alive, and how when his father and he had returned with the packs, the elephant had already started to swell even in the cool evening. There was no more true elephant, only the gray, wrinkled, swelling dead body, and the huge, great, mottled brown and yellow tusks that they had killed him for. The tusks were stained with the dried blood, and he scraped some of it off with his thumbnail like a dried piece of sealing wax, and put it in the pocket of his shirt. That was all he took from the elephant, except the beginning of the knowledge of loneliness. After the butchery, his father tried to talk to him that night by the fire. He was a murderer, you know, Davy, he had said. Juma says nobody knows how many people he has killed.
They were all trying to kill him, weren't they?
Naturally, his father had said, with that pair of tusks.
How could he be a murderer, then?
Just as you like, his father had said. I'm sorry you got so mixed up about him.
I wish he'd killed Juma, David had said.
I think that's carrying it a little far, his father said. Juma's your friend, you know.
Not anymore.
No need to tell him so.
He knows it, David had said.
I think you misjudge him, his father said, and they had left it there.
Then, when they were finally back safely with the tusks after all the things that had happened, and the tusks were propped against the wall of the stick and mud house, leaning there with their points touching, the tusks so tall and thick that no one could believe them even when they touched them, and no one, not even his father, could reach to the top of the bend where they curved in for the points to meet. There, when Juma and his father and he were heroes and Kibo was a hero's dog, and the men who had carried the tusks were heroes, already slightly drunk heroes and to be drunker, his father had said,
Do you want to make peace, Davy?
All right, he said, because he knew this was the start of the never telling that he had decided on.
I'm so glad, his father said. It's so much simpler and better.
Then they sat on old men's stools under the shade of the great fig tree with the tusks against the wall of the hut and drank native beer from gourd cups that were brought by a young girl and her younger brother, no longer a detested nuisance but the servant of heroes, sitting in the dust by the heroic dog of a hero who held an old cockerel newly promoted to the standing of the hero's favorite rooster. They sat there and drank beer while the big drum started, and then Ngoma began to build. He came out of the working room and he was happy and empty and proud, and Marita was waiting for him on the terrace, sitting in the sun of the bright early fall morning that he had not known existed. It was a perfect morning, still and cool. The sea below was a flat calm, and across the bay was the white curve of Khan with the dark mountains behind it. I love you very much, he said to the dark girl as she stood up. He put his arms around her and kissed her, and she said,
You finished it.
Sure, he said. Why not?
I love you, and I'm so proud, she said.
They walked out and looked at the sea with their arms around each other. How are you, girl?
I'm very well and very happy, Marita said. Did you mean it about loving me, or was it just the morning?
It was the morning, David said, and kissed her again.
Can I read the story?
It's too lovely a day.
Can't I read it so I feel like you do and not just happy because you're happy like I was your dog?
He gave her the key, and when she brought the notebooks and read the story at the bar, David read it sitting beside her. He knew it was ill-mannered and stupid. He had never done this before with anyone, and it was against everything he believed about writing, but he did not think of that, except at the moment when he put his arm around the girl and looked at the writing on the lined paper. He could not help wanting to read it with her, and he could not help sharing what he had never shared and what he believed could not and should not be shared. When she finished reading, Marita put her arms around David and kissed him so hard that she drew blood from his lip. He looked at her and tasted his blood absent-mindedly and smiled.
I'm sorry, David, she said. Please forgive me. I'm so very happy and prouder than you are.
Is it all right? He said. Can you smell the shamba smell and the clean smell of the hut inside and feel the smoothness of the old men's chairs? It's really clean in the hut and the earth floor is swept.
Of course it is. You had it in the other story. I can see the angle of the head of Kibo, the heroic dog, too. You were such a lovely hero. Did the blood make a stain in your pocket?
Yes. It softened when I sweated.
Let's go to town and celebrate the day, Marita said. There's a lot of things we can do today.
David stopped at the bar and poured Hague Pinch and then cold Perrier into a glass and brought it with him to the room where he drank half of it and took a cold shower. Then he pulled on his slacks and a shirt and put on alpargatas to go into town. He felt the story was good and felt even better about Marita. Neither had been diminished by the sharpening of perception he had now, and clarity had come with no sadness. Catherine was doing whatever she was doing and would do whatever she would do. He looked out and felt the old, happy carelessness. It was a day for flying, actually. He wished there was a field where he could rent a plane and take Marita up and show her what you could do with a day like this. She might like it. But there isn't any field here, so forget that. It would be fun, though. So would skiing. That's only 2 months away if you want it. Christ, it was good to finish today and have her there. Marita there with no damn jealousy of the work and have her know what you were reaching for and how far you went. She really knows and it's not faked. I do love her. And you make a note of it, Whiskey. And you witness it for me, Perrier, old boy, old Perrier. I have been faithful to you, Perrier, in my fucking fashion. It feels very good when you feel so good. It's a stupid feeling, but it fits on this day, so put it on. Come on, girl, he said to Marita at the door of her room. What's holding you up besides your beautiful legs?
I'm ready, David, she said.
She had a tight sweater and slacks, and her face was shining. She brushed her dark hair and looked at him.
It's wonderful when you're so gay.
It's such a good day, he said, and we're so lucky.
Do you think so? She said as they walked to the car. Do you think we're really lucky?
Yes, he said. I think it changed this morning, or maybe in the night.
This ends Disc 5.